You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I mean, what's that football focus doing? Last week they had Brady. This week they got Brady.
We're doing it. We're literally doing it differently from everybody else.
As a matter of fact, moving forward from this point on, I will not make reference to PML.
Ready to get into it?
Yeah.
All right. We're going team by team. I would be very careful about slinging stuff. Am I going to get sued?
Are we going legal on this?
I like football. I like football season and all the things that go with it.
The last time out, Washington quarterback Michael Penix Jr. had such an amazing playoff game that we were talking about elevating him into the first round, elevating him to the top half of the first round. And this time around, we're left wondering just how many rounds he cost himself with that national title game performance. To help work through some of that and many more questions, the fallout from Black Monday, the coach firing search, all that kind of stuff, is our guy Trevor Sikkema. How's it going, Trev?
It's going great. What a weird national championship that was, but congrats to Michigan getting it done. Undefeated season, 15-0. I know we're going to dig into a lot of that, but yeah, good to be with you, my friend.
Yeah, a lot of fallout from that, not just draft related, but obviously coaching as well, with Jim Harbaugh being one of the biggest right. names talked about for the NFL coaching cycle. It was an interesting game. You're right. Like I actually watched the whole thing. We were debating whether or not that was going to happen yesterday, and I was put very much against it once Steve was threatening that the game would last till 1 a.m., given how college football works. And after, like, the first quarter, I don't think the first quarter was even over, I was like, well, this game's done. this is no longer a contest. I think we can, you know, forget the rest of it entirely. And then, you know, it became more of a contest and then stopped being again late in the game.
Yeah, unfortunately, the very beginning of that game was not quite what it was the year before with Georgia and TCU,
right.
But very early in Georgia TCU, similarly to last night, you went, oh no, one of these teams is desperately outmanned in the trenches, like both trenches. And it just was not going to go well after that. I mean, they had said it on the broadcast, Michigan averaged 19 yards per yeah. carry in the first quarter, and it's just like they none of Washington's defensive linemen could make an impact in that game, and really there was nobody that whole year outside of Braylon Trice who was able to do too much, and he was more of like a pressure producer than he was like a run defender. So that game, and unfortunately Washington's team as a whole, played very well into what Michigan does, and that is control the football, run the football, win the defensive line of scrimmage as well on the other side. So it just came down to and was a reminder that football is won up front.
Yeah, I forget where the point in the game was where this stat was shown, but Michigan at one point had like 150 yards before contact, and it was sometime in the first half. Like wasn't, you know, I can't remember whether it was first quarter, how far into the second quarter, but it was before halftime. That's an absurd number. I mean, 150 yards before contact in a game ever is a big number. For it to be within one half of football is nuts. I mean, it's completely non-viable. They were averaging whatever it was, 19 yards per carry. It was just, they were getting wrecked. But they did clamp down after that. Like, Washington's defense actually, I mean, you can't say it wasn't the problem because, you know, the game definitely got away from them on multiple occasions. But they did enough over the course of the entire game to let the offense get back into it, and they couldn't really.
Yeah, I mean, the final score made it look like it was kind of a blowout, but it, basically up until 7 minutes left in that game,
yeah,
it was anybody's contest. You know, Washington was still behind. Like, they could not overcome that and even tie the football game in the second half, but they were there the whole time. I mean, it was a 7-point game for a really, really long time, and if it was a two-score game, it wasn't that far out of reach. And so, yeah, I mean, they fixed some things. Obviously, they clamped down, and you know, it was, I don't know if they really changed something schematically or if it was just the defense going to the sideline and the coach basically looking all of them in the eye and being like, look, either you play better or we get blown out. Like, that's it. Like, either you hold the line of scrimmage better from this point forward, or we're about to get blown out in a national championship game. And I think they probably just took a lot more pride in it after that. But yeah, there's no doubt about it, man. Michigan punched him in the teeth, and you kind of teased it. Michael Penix Jr., not just against Texas, I would say through most of the second half of this season, has been really, really good. And that Texas game was his best. I mean, it was his best game under pressure. It was his best game when it came to ball placement deep down the field, his confidence, how he navigated the pocket, all that kinds of stuff. And that game, I talked about it like it was very similar to what we saw from CJ Stroud the previous year. The difference is, Stroud's team lost in that game, yeah, so that's all we remember from CJ Stroud. There was no repeat. There was no next game for Stroud, and unfortunately for Penix, there was a next game, and basically all of the criticism of Penix and who he is as a prospect reared its ugly head multiple times last night. So if you were on the fence about Michael Penix at all whatsoever, him showing you basically all of his blemishes, right? Ball placement issues, struggling with touch, not setting his feet correctly. I got injured a couple of times in that game. He's got the injury history, so people are just going to bring that up, even though it's probably not related at all whatsoever. Like, everything that you had negative to say about Penix played a major factor in how the game ended up last night. So it sucks, man. It sucks, not just as somebody who recently was kind of like, oh, okay, I guess Michael Penix is a true, legit first-round quarterback, but he was one of those guys where he was playing so well. He played so well against Texas. I wanted to see that be the version of him moving forward, because that's fun. That would have been fun to see that version of Penix in the NFL. And not that we still can't. It's just more complicated now, which is a bummer. I wish we could talk about him glowingly the way that we have throughout the second half of the season. But this game's going to be ugly when you look at his scouting report.
Yeah, the Stroud thing is interesting. Steve made that same point last night when we were talking. Like, the best thing that could have happened to Penix, ironically, would have been, you know, somehow Washington's defense finds a way of not getting it done last week, or the last yeah, game, right? If he has that game, and then somehow Texas escapes at the end, and they get the win, and all we saw, the last thing we saw was him having this incredible game going down in a valiant attempt that wasn't his fault, the narrative would be completely different. Instead, you get that one extra game, and he has an absolute nightmare where, you're right, all of the concerns people had about him as a prospect all showed up. It was a bad game. He was overmatched as well. Like, it wasn't, you know, it's not like he just had a bad game out of nowhere. I mean, his offensive line had real problems, and instead, I mean, it really is. It's going to be a swing of a round, I think. It's going to be, we were hearing top half of the first round talk off the back of last week. Now you're like, he's not making it into the first round off the back of that.
Yeah, because I think the conversations with him, I mentioned some of the deficiencies that you see on film from him, right? He's not the most prolific thrower when it comes to over the middle. They don't do that a lot in Washington's offense. They're a lot more to the sideline. And so there's not a lot of consistency, a lot of production that's like over the middle stuff from him. He can throw the fastball extremely well, but the issue with him has always been touch. You know, can he take a little bit off of it when he needs to, which is a very, very important trait that you need to have as an NFL quarterback. And that was, of course, like, did not look great last night as well. I think the constants with him of why, even after the Texas game, people might not fall in love with him is, one, the age. You know, he's a sixth year player. Okay, so he's been in college football a long time. So he's not as young as nearly a lot of these other guys are going to be. So he's a little bit older of a prospect, which, honestly, grand scheme of things, if you're a good quarterback, you can play into your mid 30s anyway. So it's not as big of an issue for me as it is for some other people, but age is an issue. The injury history, obviously the two torn ACLs, the shoulder injuries, the season ending injuries, all that kinds of stuff, gets hurt last night. He's playing through pain. You can clearly see it. So you give him that competitive toughness, which you like to see. But you know, injuries are now like something where if you don't have that incredible Texas tape that you can hang your hat on, now all of a sudden you go, all right, it's tape that I like, tape that I don't, plus the injury history. Now I think I agree with you. That weighs more than it ever did. And it's, yeah, I mean, I think that the fact that it was for a national championship is going to leave a bad taste in people's mouths. And I agree with you. I felt like he was trending in the direction of being a top 20 pick. You know, I had him to the Falcons at number 8 in my latest mock simply because there's so many teams that need quarterbacks and I'm kind of putting these quarterbacks in certain spots, but I felt like he was trending towards being a top 20 pick. Now, I think more GMs than not are just going to say, yeah, age, injury, and, you know, the tape is still hot and cold. So it feels like he's more of a second-round pick now than he would be a first-round pick. I agree, which sucks, but it is what it is.
I wonder if it makes him more likely to, you know, accept that Senior Bowl invite and try and, like, do some damage repair during that
now,
week.
Now he has to.
Yeah, like, before that, you could have said, well, it's really close after the national title game. I don't know if I want to go through that, blah, blah, blah. Now you'd be like, I mean, dude, you have one, there's one on-field potential area now for you to roll this back, and it's the Senior Bowl. It's the week of practices, more important than the game itself, but that's your one shot. Outside of that, it's got to be interviews, it's got to be all the other stuff, and this game is out there, and there's nothing you can do about it. The Senior Bowl is a way for you to actually try and tangibly readdress that on the field, so I'm sure that conversation is being had right now with him and his representatives. And, you know, I think it will probably be good for him to go to that week and try and fix it.
What would if he's healthy, right? Yeah, I mean, people talked about him maybe having a rib injury. You know, he was kind of like grabbing his ribs and limping off the field.
And that ankle.
Shoot, I mean, he's got a weird throwing style as it is. You know, the throwing motion is very unorthodox. You know, it's lefty, so people don't like looking at it in general just because it's a lefty. But the footwork is really inconsistent with him. The follow through feels kind of like all over the place. It's just very unique. It's unorthodox. And so to me, I agree with you. He has a chance to re-elevate his stock if he goes to the Senior Bowl. But for a guy who might be banged up and does not have the cleanest mechanics, do you want to throw to receivers that you've never thrown to before? I mean, it also, where the Senior Bowl has a chance to help him, it also has a chance to hurt him because Bo Nix is also going to the Senior Bowl. Spencer Rattler is going to the Senior Bowl. Michael Pratt is going to the Senior Bowl, right? Like, there are good quarterbacks that are going to the Senior Bowl. And where he could help himself, if those other guys that are throwing next to him look more healthy, look better, throw into those new receivers, you might go, damn, okay, that's solidifying your day two draft status for him. So maybe it's just a risk worth taking anyways. Maybe he needs to just kind of prove himself again. Right. Certainly if he wants to get back into that full-time first-round conversation, he needs to do it. But he doesn't come without the risk, especially if he's not going to be healthy when Mobile rolls around.
Did you see the video of his throwing motion reversed? Like someone had flipped the tape over and made him righty?
No.
It's fascinating. I don't know why, but I feel like I feel like every single lefty quarterback I see when the tape is flipped, I feel differently about their throwing motion. Not necessarily better, but it's definitely different. And maybe it's just my broken lizard brain, but I feel like it's worth looking at every single lefty quarterback through that lens, because you're whatever it does, if nothing else, it just puts them on the same baseline as other quarterbacks, and you have a better, you know, you have a better comp for them than you do trying to like parse what his throwing motion is, even though it's completely reversed in your own head.
Yeah. Look, guys throwing with their left hand is weird no matter how you look at it. Maybe we should just abolish all lefties. Like if you're a lefty at all, it's just like, nah, you can't get into any sort of throwing sport at all whatsoever.
I feel like that's something that used to happen and is very much frowned upon these days. Like my granddad was of the generation where they like tied your hand to pieces and like made you write right-handed. So he had this like illegible scrawl for handwriting because he was a left-handed kid where they literally like taped up his hand and forced him to write with his right hand. I'm reasonably certain that that's very much frowned upon from an educational standpoint these days. I'm not sure you can bring it back for throwing mechanics.
No, you know how we say like, oh, this guy played left tackle in college. He could play right tackle now.
Yeah.
Let's just do that with Michael Penix. Let's just be like, no, he threw with his left hand in college. Now he's going to throw with his right hand.
Yeah.
That's what we're going
to
do.
Look, I'm not going to tell you how to do your thing, but I wouldn't be pushing that as a thing going forward. Anyway, before we get into some of the more fallout from this game and other topics, we're going to talk about securing your family's financial future, starting with life insurance. Fabric by Gerber Life makes it quick, easy, and affordable to protect your family so you can get back to enjoying life. Fabric was designed by parents for parents to help you get a high-quality, surprisingly affordable term life insurance policy in less than 10 minutes. Fabric has flexible policies that fit your family and your budget with quality policies like $1 million in coverage for less than a dollar a day. Get your personalized quote in minutes and then apply when it's convenient for you. It's all online and on your schedule. You can go from start to covered in less than 10 minutes with no health exam required. Join the thousands of parents who trust Fabric to protect their family. Apply today in just minutes at meetfabric.com/PFFNFL. That's meetfabric.com/PFFNFL. M-E-E-T, fabric.com/PFFNFL. Policies issued by Western Southern Life Insurance Company, not available in certain states. Prices subject to underwriting and health questions. All right, so who are some draft-relevant people beyond Michael Penix Jr. who had good or bad games?
You know, I brought up kind of the trenches before, and you know, there's some prospects in the trenches both this year and next year who are really good players. We kind of talked about how Washington's offensive line up front got absolutely manhandled by Michigan's defense, but I do think that Troy Fountenau, their left tackle, played well. He was certainly the best offensive lineman from Washington's bunch. Yeah. He's somebody who I don't think he has the arm length to really stay at offensive tackle at the next level. He's just going to struggle with one-on-one blocks in space, losing that length battle against NFL edge rushers. But I'm already projecting him to be a center guard at the next level. And for what we saw last night, blocks out in space, him as a puller, you know, him handling guys with power, like that's the stuff that's going to translate really well. So I thought that he played well. On the flip side, Michigan's offensive line looked really, really good. Drake Nugent, their center, he's been fantastic all year. He could be a play for one of the best centers in this draft. I don't think he's going to be center one or anything, but he's somebody who could certainly be a pro. He's a guy that you want to keep your eye on. Trevor Keegan, the guard as well. Zach Zinter wasn't in this game because he got hurt a couple of weeks ago, well, a month ago now. But I mean, he would have been another addition to this list. So Michigan's entire offensive line, I think you've got to pay attention to a lot of those guys. On the defense side of the football for Michigan, they're two interior defensive linemen. One of them is draft eligible. One of them is not. Chris Jenkins Jr., which is, you know, longtime NFL defensive tackle, Chris Jenkins Sr.'s son. He was awesome last night. I mean, he wins predominantly with power, but he was doing so in a way that was so violent. It was getting into the backfield very quickly. He was able to play more free because he could get off blocks really well. Known as more of a run stopper, but I thought he showed some really good flashes as a power pass rusher last night. So he was fantastic. But then, man, the standout player, I would say, from the college football playoffs is interior defensive lineman Mason Graham from Michigan. I mean, he was a monster against Alabama's offensive line. He was a monster against Washington's offensive line. He is incredible. Now, he's just a true sophomore, so he's not even draft eligible, but that dude's going to start very high on the interior defensive line list for next year's draft for what he can do, again, as a power player from a nose tech to a three technique guy. You saw him with some swim moves, some push pulls, getting across guys' face, you know, one gap penetration, two gap run stopping. Like, he was doing it all last night, and I think throughout the college football playoffs. So I think trenches really told the story last night, and Michigan's got a lot of dudes on both sides of the trenches that are going to be future pros.
Yeah, and because the offensive line was so dominant, like, of course the running backs are going to look good, but both Blake Corum and Donovan Edwards had really good games, obviously, and looked good doing it. It's always going to be difficult to separate that from the blocking. You know, what does that look like if it was just an average blocking performance from Michigan? But because it was so dominant, I think both guys got a chance to look at their best. You know, Blake Corum, I think, is a really good running back. I think he's the best running back in the class. I wasn't in love with Donovan Edwards at all when I watched his tape earlier in the year, like the sort of first exposure to him. But this game, I think, sort of showed you, you know, what could be there. Like, if you can get this guy, and in particular, like, I'm sort of slightly reassessing my opinion on him a little bit because of the home run ability that he showed really well in this game. which I think is now a bigger deal than it used to be. Just the, if you look at PFF grades this year for running backs, all of the top guys are like those explosive, smaller, faster running backs that can turn a crease into a 20-yard gain in an instant, right? And I think the way that the league is going now is playing towards the strengths of those guys more than it ever has. So if you have a running back whose specialty is that type of stuff, right? If you can get him in any kind of space, he can break off a huge gain. I think that's maybe more valuable than it was in the past. So that pushes guys like Donovan Edwards up a draft board relative to even 3-4 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, if you're a better athlete, you're going to be able to stand out at positions that demand more athleticism, and running back is one of those where it's predicated on athleticism. So Donovan Edwards started top 50 on the board for me going into the season because, you know, it's kind of, I do feel kind of bad because if your first exposure to Donovan Edwards was what you just saw from this season, like in the episodes that we did with running backs, if you only watched his 2023 tape, you're going to be very disappointed. You're not really going to see an impact player because outside of last night, I would say Edwards has not been a factor really at all this year. Neither is Corum, honestly. The running game for Michigan was so much less explosive this year than it had been in previous years, and that's with a good offensive line in front of him. But Edwards, if you go back to 2022, I believe he led the country or was tied in 50-yard runs and 60-yard runs last year. He had like six of those combined. So he is somebody who always has had that home run threat, that crazy athletic ability. You certainly saw it on the second touchdown run from the national championship game. It was really great blocking. There's no doubt about it. He got a running lane, but you could see when he was like, oh, okay, here it is. I'm turning on the Jets. You go, that's an NFL running back. Like that's somebody who's got difference making NFL athleticism. The issue for me has always just been, I don't think he sees the field. I don't think he sees chaos nearly as well as he needs to.
They're almost like polar opposite players, him and Corum. Because Corum had a run where he broke one off and then like ran out of gas, like hit the rev limiter and got caught from behind. And you're like, if you gave Blake Corum Donovan Edwards' home run ability, you would have like the best running back prospect in years.
Right.
And vice versa. If you gave Donovan Edwards Blake Corum's vision and – you know, knowledge for how to set up blocks, where to go, where to hit the hole, you'd have, again, an elite running back prospect. But each one of them, like, that's why they were, you know, they're a devastating combination as two of them, but it didn't quite, each one of them has at least one thing that the other guy has that they don't.
Yeah, and it's kind of disappointing. You know, when I look at Blake Corum, certainly this year, I get a little bit nervous because he had the knee injury late last year that did not allow him to play in the college football playoff and down the stretch for Michigan. It was the reason why he ended up coming back. And look, you know, national championship, perfect season. I'm sure that he's happy with the fact that he came back to school. But the injury sucks because this year, Corum was always going to be a little bit limited athletically when it came to like top speed. But his sophomore season getaway speed, if you will, was still fine. He's like 5'8", so he's just got short legs. He's got short strides, but he's a fast, athletic dude. So even for as short as his stride lengths were, you were like, okay, the speed's not difference making, but it's adequate for the pro level. This year after the knee injury, he wasn't even that. And at that point, it's like, man, if you're hardly even adequate from a speed perspective, for as good as your vision is, we see guys make it happen for the NFL all the time, but feels like there's always like, oh, okay, one or two really nice years from them, and then the team tries to replace them with a more athletic player just because that's what the position's all about. So both Corum and Edwards, there are things to like with them as prospects, but ultimately this year they did not do very much outside of their offensive line. Both of those players had less than a 2.0 missed tackles force per attempt average, which what you want is you want above a 0.3.0, and they weren't even above 2.0. And then when it came to yards after contact, neither of them hit that four yards per carry average after contact that you kind of want to see in some of the better running back prospects that we've seen over the last couple of years. So it's like, man, good college players, good backs, things to like, but it goes into that conversation of how high am I drafting this running back class? Because you mentioned that you like Blake Corum the most. Maybe I'll like Blake Corum the most as well when it's all said and done. But what does like the most mean? Because we're still probably not picking any of these guys in the top 40, maybe not even top 50, maybe not even top 60. I don't know. So that's, I think, the conversation.
Yeah, and I think because of the sort of way that those explosive players, the home run hitters, are more valuable than ever before, I do think there's a slight corresponding connection to guys without that home run gear being slightly less valuable than they were. But I still think they can be really good NFL players. Like David Montgomery is probably one of those examples, right? David Montgomery doesn't have that home run gear. I know he had one big run this season, but he's still a really good running back at the NFL level. He just is not going to break off any generally 50-yard runs because he doesn't have that kind of top-end gear. I think Corum probably fits.
Well, it's because he's got the feet of Ezekiel Elliott and the strength of Derrick Henry and the vision of Emmitt Smith. And, you know, I, for anybody that's listening, the graphic meme that was posted many, many years ago where somebody basically compared him to the greatest running back prospects of all time.
But notably absent from that list was a comparison of speed to, like, you know, Bo Jackson or whatever. They never gave him that.
Like Saquon Barkley or something crazy?
I don't think they ever gave him speed one. I don't think that. Anyway, point being, David Montgomery is still a really good NFL running back, albeit one with a defined weakness to his game relative to some other players. I feel like Corum can be the same kind of player, where he can be a really good NFL running back, but you just know that if he does get into the third level and he's trying to make it 80, he's probably only making it at 70 before somebody catches him. And I'm okay with that.
The graphic says athleticism of Sony Michel.
Okay, so that isn't speed.
Feet of Saquon Barkley, vision of Le'Veon Bell, which is incredible at the time. Strength of Ezekiel Elliott, and then the athleticism of Sony Michel. Yeah. That was the David Montgomery Frankenstein.
But notably absent from that is speed, and that's his Achilles heel at the next level.
That's true.
Anyway,
true.
So I
literally his Achilles heel.
I wanted to bring this up because the last time we talked about Blake Corum, it prompted an email to come in to point out how stupid we were. Dylan Callahan emails in, says, "Hey, I listened to the show today about running back draft prospects and wanted to correct a statement made. When talking about Blake Corum, his height was brought up as a way to talk about his top-end speed. This argument is brought up way too often since people think that taller equals faster. If this was the case, then Wemby would be the greatest sprinter to ever live." He's not, in parentheses, just in case you were confused about whether Wemby was the fastest man alive. He's not. This is almost never accurate. Usain Bolt is the exception to this. To drive this point home, the average height for a 100-meter athlete is only 5'10". Out of the 8 spots in the 100-meter final at the Olympics, only 3 of the runners were above 5'10". Here is a list of more sprinters around Corum's height at the Olympic 100-meter finals. And then, you know, a bunch of names are all 5'9 or below. I don't even care about Corum. I'm just passionate about running, and I hate this narrative. So there you go. You can't.
Okay.
It's okay, not because he's short.
But this person also kind of makes our point for us. We're not saying that Blake Corum can't be fast because he's short. We're saying that because he doesn't have elite athleticism, his stride lengths are shorter because he is short. Therefore, he covers less ground because he doesn't have that crazy elite type of speed. Like, look at Tyreek Hill. Tyreek Hill is what? 5'10"?
Yeah.
Tyreek Hill is like one of the fastest dudes on the planet. So we're not saying that you can't be fast if you're short, but why is Usain Bolt the greatest sprinter of all time? Because he's 6'5". It's because he has that twitchy, crazy, explosive athleticism and his stride length is longer. It's how the body is built. When you have that explosiveness and that twitchiness, but your legs are longer, you physically cover more ground. That's what goes into it. So I'm not saying you can't be fast if you're tall, you can't be fast if you're short. It's just kind of like a body composition thing. When you're not elite at it, you have shorter stride lengths, sure, it can go into like body control. I think the point that they make about a lot of sprinters, the average height for sprinters is smaller because a lot of times you get more concentrated power out of it. But if you get a person who is bigger and athletic in a similar vein, then you get guys like Usain Bolt. Then you get guys like DK Metcalf, where it's like they're covering so much ground with every single step, they're going to beat out the guys that don't cover as much ground.
I also wonder what impact being fully clad in football pads has on that kind of stuff. You know, like, NFL or sprinters, Olympic sprinters are all wearing Lycra, right? They're all, you know, there's nothing they're carrying. It's just themselves and their weight. In the NFL, you've got to maneuver yourself around equipment, which is not, you know, it's something. I'm not saying it's like it changes massively the dynamics of play, but, you know, a smaller guy having to deal with all of the pads and helmet stuff might be different to a bigger guy. But I agree with you. Like Randy Moss, you can't tell me that if Randy Moss was only 6'1", he would have had the same ability to glide past people when he's in that acceleration phase that he did because he's 6'4", 6'5". Like that stride length was the difference between him and other really fast guys who were only like 6 foot tall. The length that he was able to bring to the table, I absolutely think helped that acceleration phase where he just blitzed people for speed. Now, it doesn't, you know, it's not saying all 6'5" people have that, but if you're already fast as hell, being 6'5" makes a difference.
No, and in fact, it's the opposite. Most 6'5" people don't. That's why when you get guys that are physically bigger and are still just as athletic with more muscle to move, more of a body to move, those are the kinds of players that you draft high because they are winning, you know, the genetic lottery, if you will. They are tall and still athletic. Normally, scouting reports are all about pros and cons, the give and take. Okay, he's explosive, but he's not big. Okay, he's big, but he's not explosive. Like, you're talking about that with a lot of different prospects. The rare guys that are in, like, whatever, however you want to draw it, like the top right corner of the quadrant, you know, you're maxing out one, maxing out the other. Those are the guys that you go after. And so those, that's what, when we talk about like speed and stride length and covering ground and things like that, it matters more when you're bigger. Just because if you are able to do those things with more mass, with more length, more height, more size, it means more. There's just less guys that can do it.
So one more thing to come out of this game before we move on to other topics, and it kind of transitions into those topics. Where do you think Jim Harbaugh ends up? Because it does kind of sound like he is, whether he's intentionally maneuvering himself this way or simply he has been maneuvered this way, he is being seen as maybe the, you know, head coaching candidate to have this offseason. And unusually, when it comes to coaches coming from the college ranks, this is a guy with proven experience at both levels of success, right? He's not just an amazing college coach that hasn't had the NFL success. He's been good at both levels and is therefore, I'm assuming, seen as a far safer prospect than some other kind of college superstar names to put themselves in the NFL sphere.
Look, if he doesn't go to the NFL now, I think he will coach Michigan for a couple more years and then retire. Like, I think he'll be done, which is kind of hard, which is hard to believe because the Harbaugh family is just, I mean, it's based around football. But he was successful at Stanford, got to coach Andrew Luck, was successful with the 49ers, made it to a Super Bowl, almost won a Super Bowl. It goes back to Michigan, the place that he and his family just have so much history with, and he just won a perfect season national championship with them. If he is going to make the jump to the NFL, it's going to be this year. And I feel like he is, because I do still feel like Harbaugh has plenty left in the tank when it comes to how many years he is going to coach. And for that reason, yes, I think that he's going to make the jump. I don't exactly know where it's going to be. I think certainly the Chargers job is intriguing because Justin Herbert's there. You already have the quarterback, but I think Washington could also be intriguing because you're going to have a quarterback option at number two. New England kind of makes sense when you think of, all right, who might Robert Kraft might be into? Because if you're going to move on from Bill Belichick, you can't just move on from Bill Belichick for like nobody. And so it feels as though name recognition, pedigree, and the fact that they're going to be getting a new quarterback as well, that also lines up well with Jim Harbaugh. I cannot see him in Carolina at all. I do not think that him and Tepper are going to mesh. That would be wild if he ends up going to the Carolina Panthers. And then for the Raiders, I could see that one happening. It's just not, it's not as advantageous as the other spots. You know, I see the report that's on there right now that there's mutual interest. I wonder if that mutual interest is more of just he's letting everyone know that he's interested in the NFL again, more than like, yeah, that's his top pick. So yeah. I would still say the Chargers and the Commanders would be the best two spots for him. But what do you think about it?
I feel like he's an interesting candidate or coach because I feel like he actually places value in the story, like the narrative. I think the concept of kind of rebuilding something is quite important to Harbaugh. So that rules out a team like Carolina because they've never really had any history to rebuild, right? It rules out the Chargers, I would imagine, for slightly different reasons. I mean, they do have history, but you're going back a long time, and it was never really sort of institutional NFL history, more AFL and blah, blah, blah. I think that starts to focus you on Washington, on the Raiders. And I don't think the Patriots thing is intriguing, but you don't want to be the guy that follows Belichick.
Yeah, but Jim might.
I
right?
doubt it.
If there's any coach that would be like, yeah, I'm the next storied coach for this storied franchise.
I just
like you'd want to be that.
I think you almost never want to be the guy that follows a legend, even if the legend's tenure went badly, because I just think inevitably, if you're not able to immediately put it back the way it was at its peak, you get seen in very, very bad light.
I agree with you completely that it's a tough situation to go to. But of all of the head coaching candidates that we talk about on these shows, who's the one who might want that position the most?
Vrabel.
Not saying that they want it a lot. Vrabel. Yeah, okay. To be fair, I didn't believe that Mike Vrabel was going anywhere until like 2 days ago when all that stuff started to come out. And I was like, how are the Tennessee Titans even doing this? But I suppose that you're right. Vrabel would be number one on that list. But I think Harbaugh is number two.
The other element about Harbaugh, though, is it's going to cost a lot of money to make it happen. I mean, he's on like $8 million a year or something in Michigan, right? So if...
Yeah, but when did he sign that like ultimatum deal?
I don't know. But my point being, like, you can't... You're going to have to make him the best paid coach in the NFL to make this happen. And are the Chargers the team that's going to make that happen? I mean, there's nothing in their history that says that's a likely outcome from them. Like Mark Davis, sure, maybe. I mean, he gave John Gruden the monster contract to make that happen. We've no idea about the other teams. Like Josh Harris is brand new to this. David Tepper is pretty brand new to this. I would imagine he would, but I agree. I think that's the least likely. Kraft, who knows? I mean, I imagine Bill Belichick has been pretty well paid over the last few years. So you sort of simply thin out the field a little bit with that, you know, knowledge that whoever is getting Harbaugh is going to be making him the best paid coach in the NFL from day one, in addition to probably needing to appeal to some sort of sense of history and storyline for Harbaugh to be interested in the first place. Like, you know, would Arthur Blank do that for the Falcons? I doubt it.
Trying to look up his contract because I actually think this might be more plausible than you were hinting at, because now this is Wikipedia. I'm just trying to do like a quick search here. Wikipedia says that he signed a 4-year contract extension through 2025, all the way back in 2021. And I don't see that he signed a contract since.
No. But my point is he's already earning $8 million a year. So that's your starting baseline.
Sure. You know I thought you were kind of talking about like the buyout.
No. So apparently
are big things. I saw a thing.
Football. No. I saw a thing yesterday that said even during the contract, the buyout was like $1 million or something. Like it was
him.
Yeah,
okay.
Like he could buy out his own deal for $1 million to go to the NFL.
But I don't know. Which teams did you say that wouldn't be willing to pay that?
I mean, I don't know if Atlanta would automatically want to make their coach the best paid coach in the NFL. I'm not saying Arthur Blank doesn't have the checkbook to make it happen, but they don't feel like that kind of team. Whereas billionaire, like what, you know, David Tepper absolutely would do that if he thought he could get Harbaugh. Davis, I think, has already shown he would with John Gruden. You know, the Chargers, I don't think would.
No, I agree with you. That would be an area where I would kind of push back on that. I would say that the Chargers, for as much as people like the Herbert Harbaugh connection, do they immediately want to make Harbaugh the highest paid coach? And you know what? Who knows? Maybe it's unanimous, right? Maybe it's
right.
He's coming off a 15-0 national championship season. Honestly, if they wouldn't have choked against TCU last year, they would have made the national championship the previous season. So clearly a massive team builder. Maybe everybody would be interested even at the higher price tag, because maybe people are fooled. You know how, you know, we, the American consumer, are sometimes fooled by like, oh, okay, here are two products. One of them's $110. One of them's $200. Well, the $200 one's got to be nicer, right? It's got to be better. We got to check out the $200 one because I don't want to bargain shop here. Maybe owners feel the same way. Maybe owners are looking at these head coaches and they go, well, okay, Harbaugh's more expensive, but there's a reason why he's more expensive because we're for sure, you know, if we land him, it's all gravy. It's all smooth sailing. So maybe owners start to suffer from some modern day consumerism there.
I saw a breakdown of his contract somewhere on Twitter yesterday, and I'm always fascinated with extremely rich people and how granular and petty they are willing to be with certain like monetary exchanges, you know, like, hey, make sure I get this expensed back, right? I got to get my coffee back, even though I'm worth like $17 million right now. There's in some ways, very rich millionaires or billionaires are way more focused on the pennies than I am, who has no money, which you could say there's a cause or effect thing happening there.
Maybe I would have
a lot more money if I was focused on getting the $5 coffee back into my account. But anyway,
you're going to start just becoming ruthless. You and I are going to go to the combine and you're going to be like, hey, brother, yeah, can you Venmo me the 1266 mm-hmm. and make sure you throw the 66 in there for your Chipotle order that I ordered?
I know that this is actually discounted when I paid, but the sticker price for this is 17 cents.
Oh,
more.
Now that's I'm going to need
the full sticker price back.
That's diabolical.
Anyway, part of his contract apparently included an apparel budget of $4,000 a year to spend on Michigan merchandise. So this is a man with a contract that's paying him $8.3 million a year and yet was still focused on getting $4,000's worth of Michigan swag at each calendar year. I'm endlessly fascinated by that. I'm sure, like, who knows? Maybe this is just the agent and Harbaugh doesn't even know about it until the guy comes to him later and says, here's your deal. But the idea that a guy getting $8.5 million a year would actually like, hey, make sure you tell him I need $4,000's worth of budget to go and buy like the same khaki pants and a Michigan polo 50 times.
That is kind of funny. I actually might respect him more now, actually. Look, no matter how much money you make,
there's always
being
room
able
for
swag. Being able to look at something and buy something and they go, yeah, nah, it's on the house. It's free. Yeah. There's nothing like it. The feeling of free doesn't change no matter how much money you have. Everybody loves free shit.
I feel like it should, though, right? Like, when you have...
No. Okay, but, look, impact might be a little bit different. Yeah. But everybody likes getting free stuff.
They do. I'm just not sure. At some point, it feels like there should be no difference to you tangibly between this is free and this is costing me so little money relative to my income that I don't notice the difference. Right?
See, that's why you're poor and you're always going to be poor,
Sam.
It probably is. You need to think like an absolute savage.
I don't. Though.
Next that's PFF contract, you got to have at least $200 a year on PFF merchandise.
Yes, absolutely. Or, yeah, what that we should start a... That's the emails we need in, right? What can I ask for in my contract, whether it's free stuff from PFF or like what absolute nickel and dime thing can I get them to credit back for me for like doing my job, right?
I'm gonna get a Slack from Chris or Austin later today, and they're gonna be like, "What do you do? What are you doing? You trying to put us out of business?" Sam now put in his contract that he needs all this free.
I need like a PFF credit that gets me one level up of the internet that I'm currently paying for, whatever that is. All right,
now that one's actually got return on investment.
Yeah. Before we get into the coaching carousel that's currently taking place, we've got to tell you that this podcast is brought to you by DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NFL playoffs. It's bringing you an offer that'll help make the playoffs electrifying. New customers can bet $5 on any game and get $200 instantly in bonus bets. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app now and use code PFF. New customers can bet just $5 to get $200 instantly in bonus bets. Only on DraftKings Sportsbook with the code PFF. The crown is yours. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit www.1800gambler.net. In New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369. In Connecticut, help is available for problem gambling. Call 888-79... Jesus. Call 888 7 877-877-877. This is not helpful reading numbers written out as words. Or visit ccpg.org. Please play responsibly on behalf of Boot Hill Casino and Resort in Kansas. 21 plus, age varies by jurisdiction. Void in Ontario. Bonus bets expire 168 hours after issuance. See dkny.com/football for eligibility and deposit restrictions, terms, and responsible gaming resources. Whew. I've never encountered that before, where somebody has written out numbers as words. It fritzes my brain out. I can't read numbers written down as actual words. Doesn't work.
DraftKings also sponsors NFL SE, so first episode where they had switched that up in their read, I was similarly like, I was just like, I don't know what to do here. And, we powered through it.
It's never occurred to me that that would be a problem. But apparently reading numbers written out as words is bizarrely difficult to do when they're in a sequence. Wow.
Yeah, we got it. We got it for next time.
Okay. Coaching carousel. So we talked a little bit on yesterday's show as the firings were already happening. We were, breaking down the news that happened. One of the things that happened yesterday, it was an unexpected and interesting development. Wink Martindale, defensive coordinator of the Giants, owner of what Steve calls the crazy defense, resigned, just up and quit. And the talk was there was sort of friction or disagreement or just general disharmony between Wink and Brian Daboll and the whole Giants setup there. This is a kind of wild development. I think he will clearly have suitors. There are a lot of people that respect that quote-unquote crazy defense a lot. It tends to get better results than you think that it maybe should, given how aggressive that it is. So I think he's going to have plenty of phone calls coming his way. And then from the Giants, they just sort of started to construct this defense along the way that Wink Martindale would want, and now he's not there.
Yeah, that's the part that's the most interesting for her, right, is that Martindale plays this kind of, like Steve said, this crazy unorthodox defense where they're throwing a lot of stuff at you and they're being really aggressive in the way that they do it. They're throwing a lot of blitzes your way. There's a lot of single high coverage, a lot of man coverage stuff, really tough responsibilities, and a lot of high demand on a lot of those defensive players. So you got to have smart players, but you got to have really good athletes too to be able to play in this Wink system. And it kind of, I don't want to say throws a wrench in things, but it's definitely interesting that we're going to follow, okay, who comes next? Like, what defensive coordinator do you go out and get? Because it's not like there's a ton of guys who are successful at this type of defensive coaching philosophy that aren't really already in these positions. You look at Brian Flores, all right? Well, he's already a defensive coordinator. You like a Vic Fangio, okay? Well, he's already a defensive coordinator. So there's just not a lot of these like hyper aggressive DCs that aren't already in positions that are there. So I don't really know which direction that they're going to go. I think the more interesting conversation piece about this isn't necessarily what happens with the Giants defense. It's okay, what happened between Daboll and Martindale?
Yeah.
Because there's clips from earlier this season where they're kind of getting into it a little bit on the sideline. And, it was obviously not a good year from a lot of different ways with the Giants. I know they suffered some injuries that were unfortunate, but you're coming off of a playoff berth. You're coming off of a coach of the year candidacy for Daboll. You're coming off of, the Giants really outperforming what a lot of people thought that they were going to be back in that 2022-2023 season, and absolutely came out, fell flat on their face this year. And I think there was a lot of friction with a lot of people in that building. So now you really get to find out, I think, what kind of head coach Brian Daboll is, because for Martindale to just kind of up and say at the end of the year, you're like, yep, I'm done. Because for as much as we want to sit here and say, oh man, there's only 32 head coaching jobs in the NFL. Like, these things are so valuable. Same thing with defense coordinators, right? And especially if you are a defensive coordinator that's under a defensive-minded head coach, sometimes you're not even fully that. So for Wink to just be like, yeah, I'm out. I'm out of here. It really had to get to a point where clearly this was not salvageable. And you have to raise your eyebrow at that, looking at Daboll and be like, all right, what went on here? Because it felt like Wink had a lot of freedom of what to do on that side of the ball. you deploy the defensive players how you want. We'll get a lot of the defensive players that you want. And I'm sure it wasn't quite that perfect, but it felt like he had a lot of respect and freedom there. Maybe he didn't behind the scenes. Maybe that's part of the story. But thinking all of that from my side of things, it raises an interesting question about what's going to happen now with Daboll and how all of a sudden, just a year removed from him being coach of the year, 2024 becomes basically a prove it year for him. Giants, if the Giants suck again, that I think Daboll's gone.
Yeah.
So that sets up an interesting year.
I mean, maybe he did have that freedom and Daboll wanted him to have less at certain times.
The
other thing is, like, if you were looking at, you know, blame around the Giants organization, I mean, I think the defense is less culpable this year than the offense was. Like, the offense was the problem for most of this year, way more than the defense was. So I don't know if Daboll was, you know, annoyed and put too much sort of blame or anger, ire in the direction of Wink, and he just got sick of that and went, look, my unit is outperforming yours, shut the hell up. But yeah, you don't tend to see that, a guy just up and quit because he's kind of fed up with how the working relationship is with the head coach. In fact, I can't think of the last time that's happened. I'm sure it has happened before, but definitely an unusual situation here. The other one that is starting to fascinate me is the Carolina searches are underway with gas being poured on this thing. They've apparently hired a consultancy firm to help them whittle down candidates. They've already requested interviews with, I think, 9 head coaching candidates, including, by the way, PFF Bobby, first year offense coordinator with the Houston Texans, is in demand for head coaching jobs. But 9 head coaching candidates, a bunch of GM candidates is already. Who wants that job, I guess, is the easiest way of asking that question.
That's the question, right? I mean, again, I said there's only 32 of these things, and so everybody should. But given what has happened in Carolina, how Tepper is yet again hiring another head coach, and it's another failed coaching search, coaching assessment, coaching tenure under David Tepper. It felt like the balance of power with Fitterer there, but he came in after Matt Rhule, so he didn't really have a lot of power. And then he kind of did when Frank Reich was there, but then Reich wasn't great. And then Fitterer's now fired. It's like, man, it just felt like the decision-making pyramid or pyramid of power, if you will, was like all out of place. And David Tepper's at the very top. We know that. But how big of a chunk of the pyramid is David Tepper? Is he actually going to allow the general manager to kind of do the job that they are hired to do? And I don't say that in just the tasks, but I also mean allowed to fail, the freedom to make the decisions, like those kinds of things. Because for as much as Tepper kind of comes out and says, no, like I trust these guys completely, they're making the decisions, I don't know how much that's the case. I really don't. So they're going to cast a wide net. There's no doubt about it. You know, Ben Johnson, I think, was requested for a second interview with them. When I say second, I mean that he interviewed with them last year before taking his name out of the hat and going back to Detroit. You know, there's you mentioned PFF Bobby is one of those candidates. Dave Canales, the offensive coordinator for the Bucs, is. Todd Monken, I think it was one of those as well. This was on the list for Dan Quinn. Dan Quinn, the defense coordinator for the Cowboys, he's got a lot of requests, and Carolina is one of them. So they're casting a really wide net, but the question remains the same. Whether you're an offensive coach, whether you're a defensive coach, whether you're young, whether you're old, who wants to work in Carolina right now? Because damn, they when you are an owner and a general manager and just a front office, you have the ability to keep things pretty quiet. You have the ability to keep things pretty closed door. And it feels like we have already figured out a lot about how frustrating it's been in Carolina. It just doesn't bode well for whoever's coming in there next. You've got to have this guarantee that you're going to be able to do the job that you were hired to do without somebody looking over your shoulder, especially somebody who has never coached before. And I don't know if that's the case in Carolina. Maybe it is. But as the head coach, you also can't come walking in that door in Carolina and tell the owner of the franchise, hey, I want full control, or I want the freedom to be able to do what I want. The owner could be like, all right, get out of here. Like, it doesn't really happen like that. And I think Matt Rhule was the guy who actually had that sort of power and it fell so flat on its face that I don't think Tepper's going to do that again.
I don't know.
I don't know the answer to the question of who's going to want this job. So we'll see.
When Schefter, I think, tweeted yesterday that PFF Bobby was getting an interview in Carolina, you know, I tweeted out being, hey, look at PFF Bobby go. The number of people that tweeted me back and said, tell him not to take that job was insane. And I get it. I mean, this is the thing. This is now a job opening where the candidates of the PFF Bobby style, you know, young, up-and-coming, sort of first head coaching opportunity type, I doubt they want it. I mean, this is why Ben Johnson withdrew his name a year ago. I don't imagine he's going to want it any more this time around than he did a year ago. Like, the interview is one thing, but I'd be very shocked if Ben Johnson became the Carolina Panthers head coach without a biblical sum of money being thrown in his direction. So,
if you are a head coach that has options, Carolina can't be high on the list.
Right. So this is what I'm saying. I think the young up and coming coaches that are sort of in demand right now are not going to want that as their first job. I think right. The other end of the spectrum, the Dan Quinns of the world, the guys that have sort of had a shot, failed, rebuilt their reputation, are hot candidates again to give it a second try. I don't think they're going to want a piece of it either, because they're like, I understand what went wrong the first time around. I need to make sure I can do all those things, whatever it is, to say that it doesn't happen again. The last thing I need is just a loose cannon in the form of ownership, like lobbing mortars on me randomly throughout the course of a given week. So I don't see them wanting to be interested in it, which leaves you with what exactly? Like the candidates that nobody kind of wants in the first place.
I think it's going to be somebody on the extreme ends of the spectrum that you just talked about there. If you are a young or old head coach and you have options, I don't think Carolina is going to be very high. But, you know, I don't think it's going to be Dan Quinn, because I think Dan Quinn's got options. But just as an argument, like, if Dan Quinn felt like this was his last shot at getting a head coaching gig, that's probably an older seasoned candidate that would take it. If you were a young offensive coordinator, like I look at Dave Canales, and Dave Canales has done some really nice things with the Buccaneers this year, but it was his first year as an offensive coordinator. It was his first year as a play caller. And so when it comes to Bobby Slovic, Ben Johnson, Brian Callahan, like Jim Harbaugh, like a bunch of these other like head coaching candidates who might have other options, they might have more to their resume to get more interviews and have more looks. I don't know how many head coach interviews this cycle Dave Canales is going to get other than Carolina. So if he gets this, and if the interview goes well enough, and if some of these other candidates that maybe they're above him end up saying no, if Canales has a head coaching option on the table, and this was the only place that he interviewed for, that's a guy who I could see taking this job, just because of, like I said at the very beginning, only 32 of these.
Yeah.
You don't get very many shots to be a head coach. What happens next year if he comes back and calls plays for the Bucs and things absolutely tank? Now, I'm not saying that that's going to happen, but what happens then? Well, then you're not getting head. Look at Byron Leftwich, right? From the same franchise. Byron Leftwich, those early Brady years, he almost had ink on the paper to be the head coach of the Jacksonville Jaguars. And then that kind of fell through. We went, some other opportunity will come up for him. Leftwich ain't even in the league. So that's where I think a young or old candidate might be interested in Carolina if they feel that is either their last shot or their only shot. And that's kind of who I ultimately think is probably going to get the gig in Carolina.
Yeah, to be clear, to their credit, every candidate I've seen named as somebody that they're trying to get an interview with, I think is a good option. Like, I think they're hitting the right names. But equally, because of that, I guess, I have yet to see a name that I think would take that job if it was offered to them. Like, I think both Canales and PFF Bobby, I think they both stay where they are for a year rather than take that job. You know, if that's the only opportunity they get, right? Whether it's interview or whether it's he interviews a bunch of places and that's the only one that offers him the job. I mean, who the hell knows? I haven't asked him, and I certainly am not speaking with any kind of inside information, but I would imagine Bobby would take another year in Houston, do it over, you know, come back an even hotter candidate next year and look for better opportunities than take the Carolina job because he's like, wow, what if that doesn't happen? You know, what if I stink next year? What if this is my one shot? I feel like those guys have more self-confidence, delusional or not, than to sort of think that way and say, I got to take this. I got to take the job.
Yeah. But again, you know, money and opportunity talks.
Money is the thing.
Tepper's got a lot of money. And I know a lot of these guys certainly take pride in it. The ones who are, who have aspirations to be head coaches will want to be head coaches, and they don't want to just go in any situation and kind of like ruin their head coaching reputation. So that's absolutely something that you think about. But like, if somebody's about to pay you, let's just say $7.5 million a year than you're currently making, and you're about to ink a 3 or 4 year head coach deal where that is fully guaranteed, that is generational wealth.
Money
that is very difficult to say no to.
Money changes everything, and the only NFL owners with more money than David Tepper are the Broncos ownership group, who already, you know, already made their move a year ago, so they're not even in the running, right? Tepper has, he is the biggest fish in whatever pool he is in financially. And yeah, like, he's also, by the way, I mean, if you read any of those sort of articles about David Tepper and what he's like as an individual, in addition to what we're seeing just from publicly available clips of him lobbing water on fans and screaming outside of, you know, rooms and stuff, he, one of the things that it sort of brought up in that is, he has so much money that he is, and he is willing to weaponize that money out of whatever whim takes his fancy, right? Now, one of the stories in an article was about him musing that he could just like buy a restaurant of a guy that was a jerk to him as a server and like ruin it, right? Just to get back. Like, you were a dick to me, so I'm going to buy your business, bankrupt it, and put you out of a job. That feels like an equal trade-off here. What I'm saying is, Ben Johnson has already disrespected the man, right? He's already said, no, I'm not interested in your job. I would rather be at a lower position elsewhere because you are such a mess. If David Tepper comes back to Ben Johnson again and is like, I'm going to ask you for a second time in a row, do you want my head coaching job? And Ben Johnson tries to turn him down again, David Tepper is going to back up all of the money in the known universe and say,
he's going to buy the Lions.
Right, and say, all right, turn me down now, Ben. I dare you. I am offering you $15 million a year. I dare you to turn it down.
No, at that point, he's going to sell the Panthers, buy the Lions, and then fire Ben Johnson.
No, he can't. So that he knows that he can't like ruin him. So what he has to do is to make him accept the job, right? And the only way to do that is to just keep increasing the number of zeros on the end of the offer until he says yes.
I mean, that's my dream scenario.
But I think that's the one area where it could all change, right? He could offer somebody the job.
It's the money thing. But again,
they say no.
I think that these coordinators who have options elsewhere, or know that they are solidified enough to maybe have options in the future, which I will say is a very risky thing to do, right? We talked about some of these other guys who have been offensive defensive coordinator candidates, hot on one side or the other, and it just has fallen through. They never became head coaches. I think it happens all the time. So the time, and to think that you might have that opportunity a year from now, 2 years from now, whenever it is, that's a dangerous game to play. But the one of money can change a lot of things for a lot of people.
And it changes it even for people that are filthy, stinking rich. You know, like, you only have to look at how the sort of the Saudi Pro League in soccer is busy. You know, just they throw money at players that are already rich. These guys have been earning, you know, $200,000 a week for the last X number of years, and Saudi is still able to throw like game-changing money at them to the point where they're willing to go over and change everything, you know? So I think it's David Tepper has the financial firepower to change the conversation, even to people that have made millions and have millions and are sitting there with a lot of money already. Like, if David Tepper wants Dan Quinn, I'm sure Dan Quinn has made a boatload of money already in his NFL career, right? David Tepper can still change the dynamic with the number of zeros he puts on the end of that offer to Dan Quinn in a way that might make him change his mind. You know, he's got that kind of financial firepower, absolutely. So let me wrap up the conversation with head coaching. Which is the job you would want the most? And I include, so the available jobs, the ones that are already open right now, but also include the ones that you think might come up. So we assume, I think, at this point that New England is going to be available. Mm-hmm. If Mike Vrabel goes to New England, you know, Tennessee becomes available. So which job, either currently available or theoretically available, are you most interested in if you are the next head coaching candidate?
To me, it's easy, Washington at number one. We had an episode on NFL Stock Exchange where we fixed to the Commanders, and we went through a lot of things, and we talked a lot about Josh Harris and the new ownership group that is there. And I talked about this on the podcast. I'm 32 years old, okay? Dan Snyder bought the Washington franchise in 1999. I've never really known Washington franchise to be anything else other than Dan Snyder's. And so for a long time, the better part of the last 20 years, people have told me that Washington has this rich history and this deep, passionate fan base, and that, you know, when Washington's good, it's just so much better for the league and all that. I've never known that. The only thing that I've ever really observed from Washington are, of course, like, you know, kind of the RG3 years, which they had some craze there. But outside of that, it was, you know, bad Dan Snyder report one year after the other, how bad it was to work there, how toxic of a workplace it was, how cheap he was in so many ways, how he cut corners, how fans didn't even like him. And so I've always kind of felt like Washington was this second tier, third tier NFL franchise. It's never been legit to me. But with Harris taking over, looking at how experienced that he is with running pro sports franchises, you know, he's a majority owner of the Sixers, of the New Jersey Devils. He's also like part owner of some other sports teams as well. Like, he's very experienced in this. You look at some of the help for consulting hires that he's had for this, not general manager process, but head coaching process. You know that he's going through it in a very serious way. They have the number two overall pick. So you're getting either Caleb Williams or Drake May on a rookie contract. That's guaranteed. You have a lot of money to work with in free agency. Not a lot of that roster is entrenched. A lot of it can be flexible, especially over the next two years. You have the opportunity as a head coach to build that team however you want, with a brain trust that sounds really great in theory. Obviously, we'll see if it works, but a really great brain trust, an experienced owner, somebody who knows what it takes to win, somebody who's already learned a lot of ownership life lessons, but isn't Dan Snyder, a fan base that will be rejuvenated and very passionate once that dial starts to turn, if you will. To me, it's Washington. I think that there, just everywhere you look of why you would want this head coaching gig, I think Washington checks those boxes.
Yeah, I think Washington makes a lot of sense. And actually, there aren't many available right now that you think are great jobs. Like, Washington probably is. It depends a little bit on what Josh Harris is going to be as an owner, which at the minimum now I think is unknown, right? If you're the candidate coming in, you can't be certain about it, even if you think, okay, track record, other sports, all those kinds of things. There's a lot of good things right now, but it's guesswork, you know? And if it goes badly, who knows? That changes the whole dynamic. Carolina, we talked about, it's a horrible job right now. Even if you just looked at it in football terms, I don't think that's a particularly good job, because Bryce Young just had one of the worst rookie seasons of NFL quarterback, of any, you know, high-end NFL quarterback, high draft pick quarterback in living memory. So your job is now to fix Bryce Young, and that might not be a doable thing. And I don't imagine the owner is going to listen to that answer if that ends up being what it is. Sorry, you goofed the pick. I can't fix this guy. Like, if that's what the reality is in a year's time, you're going to be the guy that pays for it, not the owner. Right, so right. In football terms, I don't think that's a great job. The Raiders, it's always been a bit of a mess, and you've got to be the guy that meant they didn't hire Antonio Pierce. You're not going to get a lot of love for that. The Chargers, Justin Herbert makes it interesting.
It's the biggest piece of the puzzle.
Yeah, everything else about that opportunity, though, is a bit sort of strange. The one that I like a lot is Atlanta.
Atlanta's a good one. Yeah.
I think you have a good owner who's willing to invest and spend and put money in the ancillary things that some owners don't. You know, Arthur Blank wants to be at the top end of that NFLPA report card thing, right? Like, put all the money into all the other things. He's also willing to spend money like on in the playing side of things, the coaching side of things. And that roster is pretty good. Like, you really are kind of a quarterback away. You just need to find the quarterback. And unlike Washington, you don't have the obvious, hey, we're picking top two, we've got one of the top two guys. You've got to find a creative solution, or you've got to find the right guy. But theoretically, I think that is a very good job.
I also feel as though Atlanta's going to get super aggressive here in the draft. Like, I really feel that way. They've had opportunities to get quarterbacks over the last couple of years and have passed. They've played kind of like the patient game while Terry Fontenot has been the general manager for them. I think Arthur Blank's fed up. Like, I don't think you fire Arthur Smith just on a whim if you're not ready to fully change things. I really do feel as though Atlanta is poised to, sitting at number 8 overall in the draft, they are going to be a major trade-up candidate, I think. I think that they're sick of it. And I think that what you said is correct. A lot of the rest of the roster is there. You go up and you get a quarterback that can basically change everything for them. Not that they're immediately like this playoff ready, going to take over the NFC kind of a team, but you entrench a good quarterback in there and all of a sudden you're immediately within that conversation, especially if the division stays not as strong as it is right now. So I think that that is an attractive job. There's no doubt about it. And I think that Atlanta is going to be one of those aggressive teams this offseason.
No, I think that makes a lot of sense. I've got to say, I would love to see Antonio Pierce get given an opportunity with the Raiders as the full-time head coach. I think given what he's done this season, I don't want to say, I mean, yeah, he's earned it. And I think it would be an intriguing thing to watch take place just simply as an intellectual exercise. I also, though, would love to see Jim Harbaugh like bring the Raiders back to what they used to be. Harbaugh, like, rebuilding the Raiders into like the 1980s version of the Raiders, where they are this like powerful, destructive, dominant force on their side of the NFL, would be pretty amazing. Like, not just for his legacy, but, you know, they are one of those storied franchises in the NFL. They have cachet that's kind of waned in recent years because of all the misses. You know, it's not really been successful since, I mean, not even since Al Davis died, but like since before that. You know, they've been losing their way for a while. Jim Harbaugh coming back to like rebuild the Raiders franchise would be an amazing NFL storyline.
NFL would love it. NFL Absolutely. Would love it. No question about it.
All right, that's going to do it for our show today. Tomorrow we are back with our awards show. We will break down a little bit with the sort of the main AP-style awards, but also ones that PFF does all by ourselves. So not just the MVP, which, as you all know, we hate because of the value element, but the best player, the Stevenson Award that PFF does every year. Trev's going to be back to help me do that, and we will talk to you then. Thanks for listening.